Good afternoon. Illinois Appellate Court, First District Court is now in session. The Sixth Division, the Honorable Justice Sanjay T. Taylor presiding, case number 23-2007, Bulletproof Plumbing Corp versus Thomas B. Olson.
Good afternoon. My name is Sanjay Taylor, the presiding justice of the Sixth Division of the First District Appellate Court. I'm joined by my colleagues, Justice Michael Hyman and Justice Celia Gamrath. If I can have counsel for the appellant and appellee introduce themselves, and for the appellant, please let me know how much of your 20 minutes you would like to reserve for rebuttal. So, counsel for the appellant.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. My name is John O'Brien. I'm the attorney for the appellant. I doubt that I will need to use more than, put it this way, I don't know how much of my 20 minutes I will use in my opening argument, so I don't know what I will need to, but or what I will have left, but I don't think I will be taking very long in the opening argument.
Okay, and just to be clear, you represent Bulletproof and D'Amico.
James D'Amico, yes.
Okay, and counsel for Appley.
Good afternoon, Justice Taylor. My name is John Kenny of Cervantes Chatham Prince, PC. We represent the appellees, cross appellants Tom and Paula Olson. And
Okay.
I would suggest we will not need much more than 10 minutes to argue, it's hoped.
Okay, well, we'll see about that. Mr. O'Brien, I'm going to tell you when you're at 15 minutes, so you may proceed.
That would be fine. Thank you, Your Honor. Basically, I think that this case should be relatively one of the easier cases for this panel to. This is a classic case of starting with a faulty premise and thereby arriving at a faulty conclusion. The trial court treated the issue of, well, background. I'm assuming folks have read
Familiar with the facts, you can go straight to your argument.
The trial court treated this as a question of first impression under Section 7 of the Mechanics Lien Act, as to what is the effect of an untimely or an otherwise defective lien by a subcontractor on their ability to pursue a claim against the owner, where that lien would not be valid or enforceable as against a lender, encumbrance, or subsequent purchaser, and so forth. The case is not, in fact, a case of first impression at all.
Let me ask you a question. Let me ask you.
Sure.
Why does the lien form under the Act with regard to Section 7 not distinguish between liens intended for a third party effect of third party versus effect of owners? There's no distinguishing between owners and third parties in Section 7, the form, right?
I would respectfully disagree with that.
Okay.
Section 7 says no contractor, I'm reading it now, can enforce their lien, I'm paraphrasing, unless within I'm sorry, to the prejudice of any cr creditor, encumbrancer, or purchaser, unless they file their lien within 4 months. And then at near the end, it says such claim may be filed at any time after his contract is made, and as to the owner, may be filed at any time after the contract is made and within 2 years of completion. So the owner is treated very
But is it
differently.
perfected as to the owner if it's filed after 4 months? I mean, not perfected as to the owner. Perfected. Well, what would be the effect of filing it after 4 months as to the owner? You can still bring the suit, correct?
Well, correct. And the other thing is, after 4 months, but within 2 years, it's effective as to the owner.
Right.
After 4 months, it's not effective as to the third party, encumbrance or mortgage or whatever.
Right. So, with regard to the 4 months, we have here Chase. And at the time the lien was filed, Chase was still a creditor. Is that correct?
At the time it was filed, I believe so. At the
Yeah, I
time,
mean, it is. I'm not trying to
No,
Yeah,
right. At the
you're right.
time the suit was filed, no.
No, that's right. But at the time the lien was filed, and isn't that the appropriate time? The time that's important here is it's for the parties you just mentioned. It mentions all those parties. And it's for them to know that there's somebody out there. And so if their your position is, well, it doesn't matter because at the time of suit, Chase is noticed everybody. That's what's going on here for that 4 months. So in this case, because of that, it's a little different than might otherwise be. How does that affect your argument?
Well, first of all, it doesn't really, because what I am saying is that as this court's prior precedent has said, in National Theater Supply versus Bloom, and in particularly in North Shore Community Bank versus Sheffield Wellington, I would agree that whether Chase released their mortgage before or after we filed suit, we would not Bulletproof would not, under this district's precedent, be able to enforce its lien to the present. We would be second in line behind the bank. Okay. However, we are only trying to pursue it against the owner. And for the owner, there is a very different mode of notice, particularly relative to subcontractors, which is that they are supposed to, there's two methods really. The owner is supposed to obtain, and the general contractor is supposed to give the owner a Section 5 sworn statement breaking down who his subcontractors are, what they're owed, what kind of work they're doing, et cetera. But the general contractor doesn't do that, or he gives incorrect amounts. He says the plumbing contractor is owed X, but he's actually owed more than X. Section 24 provides, and that's within 90 days, the notice has to be given to the owner by the subcontractor. That was done here. The Section 24 notice appearing at page 21 of the appendix was sent on February 8th, 2019, and we now know that the Bulletproof's last day to work was November 18th, 1918, so less than 90 days prior.
But bulletproof.
So in other words, we are not, even if Chase still had a mortgage, we're not trying to enforce it as to them,
I understand that.
just to
I
the
understand.
owners.
But I was just talking about the fact that is they were out there. With regard to what happened here, bulletproof did not provide a completion date, correct?
In the lien, that's
In the
correct.
lien. All right. Okay. And there are cases that say, although the statute does not specify it, judicial decisions have, for many years now, said that it should be there. Am I correct?
You are correct as to the first district only, okay?
Oh, but we are not a court of the first district only. We are a court, I'm sure you know, there's only one appellate court in Illinois.
Right, no, I understand.
It's very confusing. Law students never realize that.
But the second district is
Yeah, they
public.
have a different decision. That's true. That's true.
So
But
that's why I said
we
there's
can
this one.
follow. It doesn't matter. I mean, we're all out there. So
But I guess my point is, yes, those decisions are out there. We're talking, of course, about North Shore Community Bank and Merchants Environmental.
let me ask you a question, because you've been in this business a lot longer than I have.
Don't know about that.
Is there a difference on how liens are filed in Cook versus the rest of the state? That is, do people downstate or outside Cook County always put in completion dates and Cook is different, or is it mostly the same? I mean, when we look at this issue here, is this an issue in the first, or is it an issue between two distinct cases that seem to go different ways?
The issue appears to be only in the first, and therefore first district, therefore only in Cook County. I have not encountered, although I haven't felt the need to extensively research it, what other districts other than the second district have said with regard to this. But again, it all comes back to, and this is where North Shore Community Bank is so helpful. Yes, the subcontractor or the contractor is definitely required to put in their, pardon me, their last date of work, but only for the protection of third parties. Three different times in the North Shore decision, at least, it says the Section 7 is for the benefit of third parties. We don't care about third parties here because there aren't any.
Well, but there was one at the time of filing of the lien.
Okay, but not at the time of filing suit, number one.
Well,
And
but
number
that's a different time. I mean,
okay.
the question, the other way, we don't even need it. I mean,
But,
what's important here is the date
well,
of filing.
Mr. Green, the issue appears to be which time is relevant, because in this instance, your client took two steps to enforce its lien. One was to record it, and the other was to file suit on it. He didn't actually, and because he was only proceeding against the owner and not, as you say, the third party such as Chase, he didn't actually need to file his lien claim or record his lien claim with the recorder. All he needed to do was sue under Mechanics Lien Act, correct?
Correct. Oh,
So,
and I'm pardon me. And also, because he was a subcontractor, he had to and did timely send a Section 24 notice to the owner, because unlike the general contractor, a subcontractor is unknown to the owner. The owner knows who they contracted with to do the work. They don't know who the subs are unless the subs send a Section 24 notice, which we did in a timely fashion.
is that Miss that Justice Hyman is raising is by virtue of the fact that Bulletproof opted to record its lien, does the entire case then become a subject to the 4-month limitation period, even though they're only proceeding against the owner?
Not according to the case law. National Theater Supply versus Bloom and Apollo Heating and Air Conditioning versus American National Bank, a lien isn't required at all if the claim is against the owner only. And I would submit that if a lien is not required at all, filing a defective lien shouldn't make things worse than filing none at all if none at all is required. That would make no sense.
So your argument is that this lien that was recorded by Bulletproof is a red herring.
In a sense, yes.
Because you didn't need it to
To pursue
enforce your
notice.
lien. All you needed to do was sue on it against the owner.
Correct.
So,
Correct.
but that argument, Judge Nixon, that argument, was that argument raised before Judge Nixon?
Yes, and Judge Nixon, unfortunately, like I say, treated this as a question of first impression, which it's
Right.
not. And second of all, as you probably read in his memorandum opinion, got into a lengthy discussion of the use of the word or in the statute, and came to the conclusion that if it's not, if the lien is not enforceable against somebody, then it's not enforceable against everybody, which is exactly contrary to the cases that he cited in his memorandum opinion. Both North Shore and Merchants Environmental allowed the cases to proceed against people other than, in the case of Merchants Environmental, it was the subsequent purchaser who bought before Merchants filed their lien. And in the case of North Shore, it was North Shore versus Sheffield Wellington. I think it was an outfit by the name of Blue Lake or something. They were allowed to pursue their claim, but it was not considered valid against the lender. Okay, that's fine.
So I'm just, for purposes of this case,
Right.
it seems to me what your basic argument is, and tell me if I'm wrong. We have two lines of the cases, one outside Cook and one in Cook. The one in Cook supports your position, right?
No, well, to put it this way, both lines of cases support my position because I'm not trying to enforce the lien against the owner. Okay. The only difference would be if this were in DuPage or some other county, presumably we wouldn't be having this discussion because they wouldn't be, no judge there would be looking at and misinterpreting North Shore or Merchants Environmental, whereas here that's exactly what happened. I mean, with all due respect to the trial court, it's, it just completely missed the point when they said that, if the lien can't be, put this here, when they read Merchants Environmental or North Shore Community Bank as saying that if the lien can't be enforced against the lender, then it can't be enforced against anybody. That's not what those cases said, but that's what the trial court ruled. One other thing I wanted to address before we get too far away. The defendant appellee raised the question of this court's jurisdiction under 304A. I don't hear any questions about this, so I assume the court is not concerned about the fact that this resolves, this completely disposes of a claim, but not the entire case as to plaintiff bulletproof.
Well, Mr. Cook, I do have a question about jurisdiction, but not the one you're referring to. I wonder if we have jurisdiction over the cross appeal, because I've never seen an instance where the appellate court has had jurisdiction over an order denying a dispositive motion under Rule 304A,
If
because
you,
it's not a final order. But you haven't raised that.
I haven't raised that because the appellee basically said if there isn't jurisdiction under 304A for them, then there isn't for us, I'm sorry, then there isn't for them. I would agree with you that they probably should not be allowed to cross appeal, but I haven't raised the issue because just briefly, that Mr. D'Amico's lien is much more clearly compliant, even with and would be enforceable even against a lender, because he said he substantially completed his work as of, I want to say, January 19th or thereabouts of 2019. So he has a completion date. He used the term substantial completion date because, of course, the general had been thrown off the job, so he hadn't finished. But he had substantially completed. I mean, he did $74,000 worth of carpentry work in a single family house. I have to assume that would be a substantial part, if not all, of the framing, the carpentry work that would be involved.
Okay, so
So
Mr. Brown, you're at
I
15
don't.
minutes. Unless you have anything else you want to say, I'll turn to your turn to Mr. Kenny.
Well, I'm more than willing to further address Justice Hyman's questions for a moment, if that's. Because it seems like he's still concerned about, well, but if he hasn't, I mean, if he wants to follow up on what we were talking about.
No, I think you have given answers. You've assisted.
Okay, I appreciate that. Yeah, I mean, basically, it's just a matter of Section 7 and its lien. It's not for the owner, that's for the third parties. We did what we had to for the owner. We filed our lien anyway. And also, the only other thing I would add is, as to the owner, a lien may be filed. May again, we're at the bottom of, I'm sorry, the end of Section 7 of the Act. If this court believes that our lien should have included a last day of work, as to the owner, the lien can be amended at any time before final judgment. So if you send the case back, I can file a new lien if the appellate court feels that we should have a last day to work in there, even as to the owner.
So why are we here?
Because the trial court dismissed the claim with prejudice and did not
Well, I guess so. Yeah,
take
good
into account
answer.
my right to amend the lien, and I
Yeah,
didn't do
right. Yes,
that, doing
true.
a futile
That's
act.
true. That is true. And you have that in your brain. Yes.
I have an aversion to futile acts. Yeah.
Okay, Mr. O'Brien, you have 3 minutes in rebuttal. I'll turn to Mr. Kenny.
Thank you.
Thank you, Justice Taylor. The court and Mr. O'Brien covered, of course, much of the facts and disputed issues. So I'll only add to what I think has maybe not been put forth yet for the court.
I'd rather hear from you
Yes.
on what has been put forth, because to me, Mr. O'Brien says something that I'd like to hear what you have to say. Because what he said is, why are we here? I mean, basically, he couldn't amend. I mean, that was my last question. Okay, I understand.
Yes.
But he's saying it really doesn't matter And when you look at Section 7, it doesn't talk about the owner, and they can amend it anytime. And he has the right to sue them for 2 years and so forth and so on. And he said, use the word red herring. That was his words, not mine. So why isn't that correct?
It's not correct. The trial court found it's not correct because
Well, but
yes.
the trial court could be wrong. That's why we're here. You know? And both
Forgive
sides
me.
say this is really clear. If it was so clear, I don't think the two of you would be here because we probably wouldn't even need to have oral argument. So you
No.
know it's not so clear.
Forgive me. Agreed. I'll just save myself describing myself as the appellee for the sake of simplicity right now. The appellees believe that the Section 7 should be read and interpreted the way that the opinion described its three possible interpretations. I'll call it interpretations for sake of discussion. It's one of those cases where a lot hangs on disjunctive use of the word or, as this court knows, and how that is then interpreted. In the last of three instances in which the trial court used the word constituent uses, when in the last constituent use, it compels an interpretation that there must be someone else in the calculus or in the analysis, and the court places that in its order. And I think it takes great pains and takes great care in describing why it came to that conclusion. And we agree that if read properly, that is the proper interpretation. That's sort of step one.
But
Yes.
why is that? Because I got confused when the judge said, that somebody else, I mean, as we went over with Mr. O'Brien, that's just not there. It says specifically who's involved. And as we talked about, they are protected in other ways. So why then would it include the owner?
I think it includes, well, it doesn't specify that, that's clear, but we think it does specify, it does require that finding because when the disjunctive is used and in the instance of just placing to the prejudice of the statute reads to the prejudice of a creditor, encumbrance, or a purchaser, unless certain requirements are met, e.g., a date, even if the lien is being enforced against, that's where the disjunctive use of against comes applied. And in the context of that sentence of Section 7, there's nobody else possibly to place in there because the constituency of encumbrances, creditors, and purchasers have already been utilized in
But
the
if
first
the
clause.
court, if the legislator wanted to put owners, they could have put owners. They put owners where they elsewhere. So
Yes.
if they didn't put it in seven, and it just doesn't seem the reason for all this, as we're supposed to liberally construe it. I mean, it's to protect people who do work like here, and they should have a right to get their payment. And that's where what we're talking about. So if you're right, it's a trick bag because of this. And to read in the word owner seems to be a potential stretch.
That's a possible interpretation, no doubt, Justice Hyman. I guess I would reflect back to merchants at one point probably seemed novel and perhaps a stretch, not to pejor anyone. But also, I think that it's really helpful to read that final paragraph on page three of Judge Nixon's opinion, where he specifies. Someone else has to be someone other than any other creditor or encumbrance or purchaser, like an owner. So it must be possible for the claim for lien to be recorded against someone else who is not a creditor, encumbrance, or a purchaser. Most importantly, it must also be possible for the lien to be unenforceable against that person if the claim for lien prejudiced a creditor, an
Where
encumbrance,
did he
or a
come up
purchaser.
with this? But he's talking about it as someone else, right?
Yes,
As
correct.
someone else. Those words are his words.
Yes.
I mean, the problem I have with it is when I read that, I said, well, wait, where did the somebody else concept? And then Mr. O'Brien started by saying, we're looking at, I mean, the judge is excellent and knows this area, but then he let himself down here and he's relying on his own words to get there. And I don't see the someone else. If you could show me where someone else is here, the only way it's here is because he said it was here.
Yes.
I mean, that's maybe that's your weak spot.
Justice Hyman, you put in a very apropos phrase, it's trick bag. I think that Judge Nixon was in a trick bag reading this. And I think he came to what his, and we believe, correct analysis that it must be, again, quote unquote, someone else. Like I think merchants had to read in some language. I think Judge Nixon had to read in some language, and I wish that the legislature, from our viewpoint, had made this clearer.
I think we
Where
all
we,
do. We have agreement on it. I think Mr. O'Brien would agree too. So
yes, I think we all went to one phrase or another. I think that it's unfortunate that it's not as clear, and I think it was proper action for Judge Nixon to take. And I know we've had some dispute on paper over whether this is first impression or not. I think it's important to note two things. One is I haven't found any of the cases that explore this phrase and its application at all, much less in my client's favor or Mr. O'Brien's client's favor, anywhere. And as we know, it's
Kenny,
hard to.
Mr. Kenny, would we, if Bulletproof had actually not recorded a lien on the property, for the plumbing work it did, but instead simply sued within 2 years to enforce its lien, would we even be here?
Not under the interpretation I think Judge Nixon gave
No,
this.
but
I
the
think
no,
it, yeah.
but under the under the fair interpretation of the statute, let's put aside what Judge Nixon said. I mean, the Bulletproof had an option to, it could have one, recorded its lien, or it could have sued. And if it were to sue, it wouldn't need it. It needed to sue within 2 years of completion of the contract, which it did.
Yes. Yes.
So your argument really seems to be that, notwithstanding that, because it recorded a lien, and at the time it recorded the lien, Chase was still a creditor. It needed to record that lien within 4 months to be effective as to Chase. But
Yes.
isn't that all a red herring when, at the end of the day, Bulletproof is not seeking to enforce any lien against a third party, and it exercised another option available to it under statute, which is to simply file suit. By
Think it's a
which
great
time, of
point. Yeah.
course, Chase was no longer a creditor.
Yes. It's a fair point and a good point, Justice Taylor. I think what explains and I think supports that the penalty of dismissal is probably best, maybe not best contained, but certainly is described in later in Judge Nixon's opinion and in footnote three, where he outlines, as in the case cited by appellants, that there is a punitive measure intended by the state legislature in making sure this was complied with, and that this makes more sense and possibly an assessment that might not be as sensible if one didn't look at the history and the intentions. I'm putting punitive in quotes, but certainly a penalty for failure to comply, and maybe a drastic penalty if one would say that they loses their statutory claim rights. And I think that's why perhaps it seems inconsistent, but I think it is consistent with the notion that failure to do these, this is a the fundamental underpinning of being consistent and enforcing these, even if seemingly inconsistent, is to press lien filers who comply with the statute so that the third parties are better protected and notified. And to motivate that, for lack of a better word, Justice Taylor.
What about the cross appeal? How do we have jurisdiction over an order denying a motion for judgment on the pleadings? I've never seen that. Under Rule 304A, at least.
It respectfully, I understand the court's position, and I had perhaps mistakenly thought to as it really I don't disagree with the court, and I didn't do it spuriously or to be flout any rules. I thought, in light of the 304A language, and in light of the fact that I think the court, you know, has been thrown this important case of interpretation, that the substantial completion date vis-a-vis what appellees are calling properly only to be a specific date requirement, we thought they were in lockstep with the argument before the court on this. And so that's why we brought it before the court. I certainly would understand and meant no, not to take advantage of a, between the 304A language and I think the parallel case, we thought it was appropriate to bring for jurisdiction before this court. I certainly can understand why the court would say, perhaps on a denial, maybe not.
Let me just ask another follow-up question there.
Yes.
Your answer will be, whatever it is fine. Do you want to stand on that, on the appeal of that issue after what you just said? I mean, which is fine. You can, and we'll decide it. Or do you want to say, well, leave it
Good.
Alone?
I'm going to leave it alone. I'm going to leave it alone, Justice Hyman. In light of the fact, I hope the court understands. I'm really trying to save time, not waste time down the road. But perhaps
I said you could. It doesn't.
No,
doesn't affect that. We'll do the work. We've already done some.
I don't like wasting the justice's time. I understand that.
You're not wasting their time.
Okay.
Anything else, Mr. Kenny?
So the dates, jurisdiction. You know, I did raise jurisdiction on the, of course, on the appeal itself, which begat our other conversation about jurisdiction over our cross appeal, and we do believe that since there still remain a breach of contract action and the quantum merit action pending, even if.
But aren't they different claims? I mean, ultimately, they're all after money, but they're really different theories, right?
I think they all stem from the same common set of facts and the same dispute. And I think that as such, this was not timely. Despite having what I'll call finality language, Justice Taylor.
Okay.
But we hear appeals of motions to dismiss with prejudice all the time. You hear and realize that it, you know, yours was motion for judgment on the pleadings, but I mean, this disposed of a claim. It disposed of count one.
Yes. Agreed. I understand where the court is going. Yes.
What about the notion that some counties don't stand by that 4 month having to put your date completion in the notice? Is that your understanding that this is unique to Cook County?
Yes, and I think it's a great question, Judge Gamrath, and I think both Mr. O'Brien and I would love to talk for hours about that because I think it's a bigger issue than what is before the court. And as far as common practice, both Mr. O'Brien and I do a significant amount of this work. So I think we could both say that many attorneys just make sure they include the completion date on all claims in all counties, just to make sure they don't forget they're in, for instance, DuPage County, vis-a-vis Cook County. So as a matter of common practice, that's what goes on with experienced claim filers. As far as the divide, I am very sympathetic and represent a lot of homeowners. I don't represent a lot of very large commercial property owners. And I believe that of say 100 clients that have walked through my door in 30 years trying to talk about mechanics liens against their single family or maybe multifamily residence somewhere in Cook County, for instance, I don't think I've ever heard one that either received or asked for a sworn statement, for instance, which of course is not before the court now, I understand. My point is, I believe that this is beyond the four corners of the case, but I think any step that can help those individuals not as experienced with the very complexity of the Mechanics Lien Act within a reasonable stretch is helpful to those people who I think get injured by it. As the court knows, oftentimes this is an instance of the homeowner paying in full the general and the general disappearing, and then the good faith homeowner and the good faith subcontractors, which is, I think, probably what we have in this case, to a degree, Justice Gamrath, are the bag holders, if you will. and the general goes off. So good to protect the subcontractors, not so good to protect the owner who is swindled oftentimes. So as far as to be back to your question, I prefer the first district viewpoint, as I think it better protects those individuals who are not familiar with the statute.
Mr. Kenny, when Bulletproof filed its complaint, they named Chase as a defendant. What allegations, well, in the complaint, did they seek to, did they seek an order giving their lien priority over Chase's lien, or did they make any allegation in that regard?
I would have, forgive me, Justice Taylor, I'd have to go back and look at the prayers, but common pleading practice is for enforcement, of course, of the lien, which then leapfrogs, if you will, most other liens, e.g. mortgages and other types of liens outside of, say, for instance, I know Judge Taylor, you're familiar with that from earlier days also, but in my experience, it's a typical pleading statement for foreclosure, if not specifying that they will have priority, certainly implying they will have priority.
And normally they would get priority, but they would have had to file within their, record their lien within 4 months.
Yes.
Okay. And here they did both. Both recorded and then sued within 2 years.
We didn't contest the time. We contested the contents of the filing.
Okay. Anything else, Mr. Kenny?
No, thank you.
Okay, thank you. Mr. O'Brien, I wonder if you know whether your complaint sought to... whether your complaint alleged that your lien, mechanics lien, should be subordinated against Chase's lien, or whether you sought to supersede Chase's lien in the complaint that you filed against Chase.
I'm looking for it right now. The I'm fairly sure I would have. A declarative of a lien, a first lien prior into the interest. Well, wait. About, yeah, in page 810 of the appendix, paragraph B, we did it, as counsel pointed out, it's kind of boilerplate in a mechanics lien action. You ask for your lien to be first and prior to the interest of any other parties. Obviously, I can amend the complaint, although it would make very little sense because Chase is out of the case. And, you know, if I had done a last minute track search before I filed the suit, they would have never been in the case because I think they released the mortgage about 2 or 3 weeks before we filed suit. So that certainly the, put it this way, there are no third parties that we're seeking to obtain priority over now. Basically, there are three lien claimants whose claims are active. There's my two clients, and then there's another named defendant, Mickey's Drywall.
Did you seek to amend your complaint?
Amended the complaint after the first motion to strike was filed because, as that motion correctly pointed out, the and this is an interesting point of argument too. Section 7 does not require the last date of work to be included in a lien. That's a first district creation, of course, under Merchants. And
my question is, did you ever seek leave to amend your complaint to drop Chase?
Well, no, because the amended complaint was filed in the proceeding in February of 22, and the proceedings since then have all been on the motion of the Olson defendants, the owners, to strike the complaint. But getting back to, if I may, for
well, and so this was a motion for judgment on the pleadings as well.
Well, the first was either a motion for judgment on the pleadings or judgment on or a motion to strike. I forget which, but it raised the issue of we didn't have our last date of work in the complaint. Now, unlike Section 7, the last date of work is required to be included in a complaint under, I believe, Section 11 of the Mechanics' Lien Act. And it's like, oops, okay, we'll fix that. And I think they also raised the issue that we hadn't attached any written contracts or explained the absence of same. So we mentioned that we don't have a copy of the general contract with the owners, and both of the plaintiffs had verbal agreements with the general contractors, so therefore no contracts were attached.
Well, so the Olsons filed a motion for judgment on the pleadings, and they argued that that Philip Proof and D'Amico's liens were invalid because it didn't include the last date of work.
Right.
And so, you know, we're talking about the pleadings. The pleadings still alleged that Chase was a lien holder. And the pleading, you're telling me, sought an order that would make your lien higher priority than anybody else's lien. So why did the judge err then? I mean,
well, because, and I'm looking for it, I believe it's page 834. There was a
a stipulation that was filed to dismiss Chase.
Right.
Because it had released its mortgage on the property in January of 2020,
right,
before the complaint was filed. So is it your argument that by virtue of that stipulation dismissing Chase, that they're no longer in the case?
Correct.
So that there's no longer a third party creditor who could potentially be prejudiced?
Correct.
By your lien
by the enforcement of our lien.
Priority.
Right. We're not trying to force our lien to the prejudice of a non-existent third party, because they're out, gone.
Okay, anything else?
Only I would say that the counsel said that he and I would be willing to talk for hours about this. I'm actually not. I think it's a very straightforward situation where we seem to have common ground that if there is no lien filed at all, we're not even having this conversation. We're not in the appellate court. When a lien is filed, that would be valid anywhere else in the state as to the lender, but not here in the First District, then it would not be enforceable as to the lender. When there's no lender, there's no defect in the lien. The lien was filed in ample time to notify anybody dealing with the property after it was filed that, hey, there's a case, you know, there's a lien, and of course there was a list pendants filed with the suit. So the you know, it's very straightforward. There simply is no, there's nothing in Section 7 that says the last day of work has to be included at all. The logic behind the opinions saying that the last day of work has to be included makes perfect sense as to lenders, because a lender or prospective lender looking at the title of the property might want to know whether they're going to be able to make the loan. When I say lender, it's probably really a title company. They're going to say, is there a valid lien here, or is this just something that somebody filed that won't actually impair a lender's being in first position? And that's well and good, but we're not enforcing it against a lender. We're not trying to enforce it against a lender.
Okay, thank you, Mr. O'Brien. Court appreciates the zealous advocacy by both sides. The matter is submitted, and the court will issue a decision in due course.
Thank you all for your time.
Thank all of you. Thank you very much. Have a great day.